stand here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And ladies and gentlemen, the media is largely controlled. Edward Bernays wrote about this back in 1928 in a book called Propaganda, where he said, you know, the intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element of a democratic society, and those who manipulate this essential mechanism are the true invisible rulers of our society. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas suggested largely by men we have never heard of, and that's really true. I mean, today we are concerned about the football and certainly, you know, who's going to go to the Super Bowl, and all sorts of trivial little incidents are blown out of all proportion. But the really important issues like the destruction, the intentional destruction of the financial stability of this nation, destroying the value of our currency, impoverishing our people, is why that's just sort of put to one side. And we're being lied to about the rate of inflation, which is not 2%. Anybody believes that? Well, they've just been listening to Rush Limbaugh for too long. And then, of course, the possibility of a war in the Middle East, an expansion of the incredible war over there, and what the implications are, and then the spiritual forces behind what's going on behind the scenes, and the fact that there's a conspiracy against Christmas, and any mention of Jesus Christ is taken out of Christmas. People never talk about these things, and we have to ask ourselves why. Well, with us this evening is certainly one of my favorite commentators. William Grigg, for many years, was senior editor of the New American Magazine, and today he writes his own blog. He has his own website, does a great job of keeping us abreast of what's going on, and we're fortunate to have him here at Radio Liberty, especially now since I am having a little difficulty recovering. And so I want somebody to do most of the talking, and we don't have any problem with that with William. Hi, William. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. It's wonderful that you have me on again.
Well, we'd love to have you here. So what are we going to talk about tonight?
You laid out quite a smorgasbord of issues there, most of them unpalatable, unfortunately, and most of what we discuss is somewhat unappetizing because, as you say, we're watching in real time the ongoing destruction. It's not merely deterioration, it's vandalism that we're seeing of what remains of Christian civilization and what I've referred to, and people much more learned than myself have referred to, as the Anglo-Saxon heritage of liberty under law. There are so many fronts on which we're under assault. You mentioned the prospect of a huge war, a metastasizing conflict in the Middle East, expanding from Iraq to encompass Iran and perhaps Syria and a number of other countries besides. We have the real possibility of another front opening up here in what is called Kurdistan, where Turkey has been conducting military strikes, and President Bush at one point actually offered to conduct airstrikes against the Kurds, who have been allies of the United States, albeit, as is always the case, very badly abused allies of the United States. One of the few things Henry Kissinger has ever said in a life almost seamlessly devoted to falsehood is that while it may be dangerous to be an enemy of the United States, it's lethal to be its friend. And Mr. Kissinger did his level best, which is quite formidable, to bring about the fulfillment of those words. It was something of a self-fulfilling prophecy when he spoke it. And the Kurds have lived that experience, unfortunately. Bush was talking about actually having assets of the United States military do Turkey's dirty work for them in beating back the irredentist Kurds in the northern part of Iraq. But the thing that I find most interesting of all the subjects we've discussed right now is what's happening domestically. You mentioned, of course, the fact that our economy is in the gravest trouble that it's ever been in. There are now people who are very authoritative talking about a return to the 30s as a model for what the economic contraction could look like.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with William Grigg.
When we see how the real estate market and the subprime mortgage catastrophe have taken a huge toll on the entire financial structure, the banking system, and the credit markets, there are a number of people who are starting to talk now about how this correction that we're confronting may be something that will be similar in terms of the dynamics to what happened in the late 20s that precipitated the market collapse and the huge contraction that's known as the Great Depression. The problem here, of course, is that you were dealing in the 1920s and 1930s with a completely different culture. You're dealing in large measure with a culture of denied or at least delayed gratification. People who are not besotted with material things and accustomed to getting everything they want and deferring the accounting for what it is that they want to purchase. It's just ludicrous. People consider it to be a huge blessing. I've considered it to be insanity to expect that a couple in their early 20s would be able to get a home pretty much the same as what their parents were able to afford later in life through diligent acquisition of the means to acquire a home on good terms. And yet it's just expected now that when one gets out of college or when one completes perhaps some graduate work in the mid-20s, gets married in the late 20s or early 30s, that you will immediately have a large home and a brand new automobile and all the material amenities that one can imagine and that one can purchase at Best Buy or some other electronics and consumer outlet, and do so primarily through the mechanism of debt, which is referred to as credit, which I think is one of the wonderfully deceptive turns of phrase in history, is that people treat debt as if it were somehow an asset, somehow a form of wealth. And a lot of this, of course, in the last several years has been financed by the housing market through creative, almost pornographically creative financing mechanisms involving the repackaging of debt as if they were assets. Well, this is all falling down. It all started to collapse a couple of years ago. Now we're finding that the world's largest banking company, Citigroup, is in such dire straits that they had to be bailed out by the ruler of Abu Dhabi from the United Arab Emirates. And this sovereign wealth fund created by the UAE, a sovereign wealth fund being this investment mechanism that is created by a government for the purpose of buying up key assets or infrastructure components in other countries. A sovereign wealth fund was created by the Emirate in Abu Dhabi, and they bought a 5% interest in Citigroup.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment with William Grieg as we begin to perhaps analyze what's happening financially. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William Grieg is just mentioning, and I think very well taken, is the fact that today young people anticipate that, you know, you get out of college, you get out of high school, you immediately go out and get married, you buy yourself a great big house and a great big car, and you do everything on debt, and everything's going to work out. And, of course, the reality is there just is no way this could happen. Now, the world is awash with money because certainly the Federal Reserve System has been printing money and creating credit and really fostering this whole incredible system of encouraging people to buy things that they really can't afford to do, specifically homes, buying them with adjustable rate mortgages, all sorts of creative financing programs, and now this whole thing is beginning to fall apart because it isn't sound financially. And Citicorp, which is the largest single bank in the United States, one of the largest in the world, is really so financially destitute and may very well be destroyed and go down that recently it's had to allow or actually borrow a great deal of money from Abu Dhabi and at really exorbitant rates of interest. It's non-voting shares that the Abu Dhabi's got. But the Abu Dhabi's buying up NASDAQ. I mean, the people from the petroleum-producing countries are simply buying up the infrastructure of America. People don't understand when foreigners own the infrastructure of your country and own your corporations, you are no longer a first world nation.
No.
Go right ahead.
I mean, we're not talking about the type of investment in our country that we saw during the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, where you had American-owned and American-operated businesses that were attracting capital from abroad. That's a very healthy state of affairs. That means that people are investing in an economy that is vibrant and productive and that is exporting things that are actually being bought and consumed abroad. What we're talking about here is people coming in and at fire sale prices, or the obverse of this is what you described here, at extortionate rates of interest, lending money rather than buying things to their advantage. coming in and basically buying up things that are assets which are being used by the productive companies. I can't remember the exact breakdown of what it is that we export to China, for instance, but if you take a look at what China exports to us, they send us finished products, many of them quite shoddy, some of them actually of fairly decent quality, almost all of which are manufactured under conditions that we would consider to be slave labor at best, but they manufacture finished products for export to the United States, whether you're talking about consumer electronics or toys or clothes or other goods of that variety. What we export to China would be raw materials of the sort that you would usually expect to be the product of a second, third, or if there is such a designation, fourth world country. I mean, we send things like scrap paper and scrap iron and raw hides to China, which are then synthesized into products which are consumed in the consumer economy. And that's the sort of a situation that led Warren Buffett to say that we're confronting the prospect of becoming sharecroppers in our own country. And when a conglomerate the size of Citi suddenly finds itself in the position of being a mendicant in its relationship with Abu Dhabi, that is a bellwether that has been largely ignored because Ben Bernanke, the commissar of the Federal Reserve, the official counterfeiting arm of the regime that rules us, was making noises a couple of days ago, Delphic utterances that were interpreted as an indication that he's going to be cutting interest rates again, which means he's going to be flooding the marketplaces, the money markets again, with another batch of counterfeited money or liquidity that is manufactured out of nothing, thereby depressing further the value of the dollars that each of us earns and each of us has in savings accounts to the benefit of politically connected interests at Wall Street. I mean, the markets reacted very favorably because this is a situation that is to their benefit.
But, you know, I think what we really need to bring out for our listeners is the fact that there are two things that the Federal Reserve could do. One would be to lower the interest rates, and by so doing, to stimulate the economy and try to keep it going. But
Yes. By
so doing, you're writing off the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody throughout the world is going to start getting rid of dollars. And the dollar is going to lose its reserve status as the currency used as a primary means of exchange throughout the world. And this is going to have a disastrous effect on America. Now,
mm-hmm. What
they should be doing is raising interest rates and cutting credit and allowing a lot of these major corporations and banks and financial institutions to go down, which is what they should do, and they have refused to do it. And this
yeah.
is nothing new. This happened in the 13th, 14th century under the Lombard system. It happened, you know, in ancient Florence. There's nothing new under the sun. Fiat money systems have been tried and failed repeatedly, and the one we're involved in, he certainly is on the verge of collapse. But we can't tell the American people. They might try to protect themselves. A few of them might even be able to protect themselves. It's only the very wealthy who are getting the money out of dollars, getting the money out of the United States, who are doing what's really necessary to protect themselves and their families. But the vast majority of the American people are simply going to be consumed and lose everything they have. And millions of people are going to lose their homes and their cars and their jobs. And
yeah.
Go right ahead.
That's already unfolding right now. As you see, one of the reasons why these credit markets are unwinding, which is, of course, a very cheerful euphemism for self-destruction. You're talking about the necessary destruction of a lot of these really bad clusters of investments and debt, people going out and buying, I believe they're called collateralized debt offerings, which is just a way of packaging together bad mortgages and then putting them out on investment markets so the people, for instance, who maintain portfolios for pension funds and things of that variety can go out and buy them. These things, of course, are all coming to naught because people are defaulting on these mortgages that were the chief means of leveraging these debts into assets that are traded in the money markets over the last several years. You talked about adjustable rate mortgages. There are even more exotic ways that people got themselves into really bad trouble. You talk about reverse amortization loans where the principal grows. That's the sort of thing that just makes me utterly aghast. I can't even imagine how you could get yourself into a situation of that sort. That's the sort of thing that, honestly, it's even worse than what Shylock was doing to Antonio in The Merchant of Venice, that type of a loan. Then you have what are called ninja loans. It stands for no income, no jobs, or assets. People who met that description shouldn't be lent money by anybody. But yet you had people who were ninjas, once again, no income, no job, no assets, were able to get mortgages, some of which were subsidized by Fannie and Freddie and Ginny, the the government-created entities that are supposedly backed by the government, but not really. I mean, that's in the fine print of Fannie and Freddie and Ginny. But the thing that I find interesting here is that these were probably the last tranche of loans that were generated the last year and a half or 2 years or so. And they were, of course, the first to go bad. And so this whole system is rotten and is falling apart. And Citigroup was very deeply invested and very over-leveraged in this. And so they were approached by the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. And they received it at a usurious rate, which is ironic because, you know, Muslims supposedly don't approve of usury. I thought that was an interesting little codicil to this whole thing. But they were able to receive enough operating capital from this buy-in on the part of the Sheikh ruling Abu Dhabi and that sovereign wealth fund to keep going until such time as they're going to collapse. Citigroup is going down. There's just no doubt about it. When it goes down, it will create a vortex like the Titanic sinking in the North Atlantic. It's going to suck down a whole lot of other people in its wake. Already, I think people are starting to edge away from Citigroup on the assumption that they can get beyond the radius of that vortex, but I don't think they're going to because the system is so incestuous here. And Bernanke, as you point out, is doing everything he can to make sure that people are still connected to this system and that some people are going to be able to get in and get out just before everything really goes pear-shaped. And so I think that what we're going to see in the next year or so, probably before next summer, we're going to see some really major hits as Citigroup, perhaps, and other entities of that magnitude either go into bankruptcy or find themselves in very dire straits of that sort. I read just the last couple of days a report by Christopher Whalen, who's one of the most insightful analysts of the banking system, somebody who publishes in a lot of trade publications for the banking industry, say the Citigroup is a goner, and that we're going to see a whole train of failures of that sort, bank runs of the sort we haven't seen in this country for decades. We've already had bank runs in Britain and a couple elsewhere on the continent. He said whoever is elected next November will go into office in the midst of a 1930s-style economic catastrophe. And that brings us back to the subject of what kind of country we've become. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, we were a country primarily made of whole families who lived together, often several generations within a geographically close proximity. We were people who understood the value of work, the value of thrift, practiced denial of gratification or delay of gratification. We were people who were able to surmount difficulties through the exertion of our creative ability, through the discipline of work and sacrifice. And we had an understanding of the fact that material things are not the measure of the existence that we've been given. I mean, we were a more conventionally religious and a more Christian culture in the 1930s than we are today. I really don't know what's going to happen if and when we end up in a Great Depression-style economic downturn. And quite frankly, the downturn that we need in order to shake all of these errors out of the system would be much bigger than the Great Depression, because you're dealing with a much bigger national debt. You're dealing with much larger dislocations
here. Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. I'll go right ahead, William.
But it, once again, is a very daunting prospect when you think about that. And we have everything in place to deal with the public here as the enemy in the event that we have social turmoil.
But you know, you go back to the way it was in the 1930s. I'm old enough to remember that. We didn't have a safety net.
No.
We didn't have a welfare system. We had a lot of people who cared about other people, and we had soup kitchens that were put up by the local communities, and we had people who went from door to door begging for food. And I remember my mother always would make a sandwich for these people. And, people had to rely upon themselves and rely upon one another. Now we look to the government to solve our problem. The trouble is the government doesn't have any money other than what it takes from us by force.
Exactly.
Or what it prints or what it borrows from future generations. We'll be back in just a moment.
You know, there is an eternal principle that if you give the government the power to give you something that...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
How, searches, widespread searches of government housing, because if you live in government housing and you are subsidized by the government, you have lost your constitutional rights. But what people don't understand is they are using the so-called threat of terrorism to take away our freedom step by step by step. And when things become increasingly chaotic, and believe me, they are going to, and those of you who have not actually seen our syllabus on the planned police state, you certainly would want to get that. Hopefully very soon we'll have our talk on that available for you. It's both on MP3 and on DVD. They're not available yet, so please don't order them. But you must understand, we're moving towards a police state under the guise of protecting our freedom from the wicked terrorists or from Osama bin Laden or something ridiculous like that. After all, I mean, Osama bin Laden is not a threat to our freedom. Our own government is, and they are using the threat of Osama bin Laden, who they have steadfastly refused to try to capture, as a justification for taking away our freedom. And the tragedy is, so many Americans are going right along with that. They are laid out preparations for building concentration camps in America. They have actually, and if anybody want to see the articles on this, they are giving Halliburton, which is Dick Cheney's old company, $385 million a year to stand by to build concentration camps. They're refurbishing the old Japanese concentration camps to the tune of $38 million. They still have many of the old army camps, only they've changed the barbed wire on those to not to keep people out, but to keep people in. Mm-hmm. And many of these concentration camps are stationed right along major rail lines. Why are they doing that here in America? Go right ahead, William.
You mentioned the Halliburton connection to all of this, which, of course, is manifold and very important. I thought it was interesting that there have been several reports in business sources, business journals, that Halliburton is going to be moving its center of operations to Dubai, which is, of course, entirely appropriate, once again, when you understand the way that the money is flowing here. The money is flowing in from these petro-dictatorships and petro-monarchies in the Gulf region. And so it's entirely possible that, in assuming that they leave office in January 2009, which may not be a wholesome assumption, that there's a very good possibility that Dick Cheney will repair to Dubai to take up residence over there in the headquarters of his once and future corporate home. And then Mr. Bush has scoped out some property in, I believe it's Paraguay,
right,
South
right.
America, which conveniently doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. I mean, it's entirely possible they're going to move offshore. Dick Cheney's been moving his assets offshore for the last couple of years, which, once again, is one of those things that should be looked upon as either a blinking red light or a waving red flag or some other very prominent, conspicuous indication that something really wrong is happening in the economy. And one other thing I thought was interesting in this connection, you're probably familiar, you're no doubt familiar with the Carlyle Group, and your listeners probably are as well, that, like the Halliburton Corporation, is very much a plugged-in, multi-purpose corporate entity that is a wholly owned subsidiary of what I call the power elite.
Well, that's James Carlucci, James Baker
III,
George Herbert Walker Bush, and yes, this is an inside corporation, only organized in the 1990s. Now it's got billions of dollars at its disposal, and it's going around buying up corporations. And but from the very, very inception, they made their money because of their connections with government.
Yep. Well, Carlyle, interestingly enough, is of course, it's always been tight with the Saudis, in large measure because of the Bush family connection. I mean, the Bushes have always been very close to the Saudis. And
incidentally, the Saudis, who financed the world terrorist movement, mm-hmm. who financed the Al-Qaeda terrorists who are over there killing our boys, why would we be close to the Saudis who are financing the whole world terrorist movement, Islamic terrorist movement, financing the Islamic schools right here in the United States that are pushing this radical form of Islam, financing the imams who are in our prison recruiting the prisoners there? Why are we doing that? Unless nothing and that we see is really as it appears to be.
Must be the case.
Right. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Gregg. And forgive me for interrupting, but these points are so important. And Carlyle is one of the key organizations. Remember, James Carlucci, one of the most disreputable people we ever had as a Secretary of Defense. James Baker III, close confidant to the President, and recently on one of the commissions to tell us what happened on September 11th. And then, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush himself, who, of course, is a great friend of the Saudis and has been supporting them for years, and a good friend of the bin Laden family as well. Well, William, go right ahead with the story.
Well, speaking of the Carlyle Group, I had mentioned before the end of the last segment that Halliburton was going to be setting up shop in Dubai, and it's already moving some of its assets there. I thought that was interesting in light of the fact that Carlyle, which is in some ways sort of the sibling of Halliburton, just recently received a big infusion of investment money from Istimar, which is an arm of the government, once again, of Dubai, the same emirate in the United Arab Emirates where Halliburton's going to be setting up its shop. And Dubai, if I'm not mistaken, is also the headquarters of, or at least to the extent that this fellow has a headquarters, of a fellow by the name of Victor Boat, who's an ex-KGB general, who has the world's largest fleet of air transport vehicles, and he's somebody who's like a character out of a James Bond film. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people in this particular tenebrous underworld are a little like the stereotypical Ernst Blofeld-type James Bond uber-villains. Victor Boat is about my age. He's in his mid-40s, I think. He's certainly made out well for himself because he was heavily involved in providing the air transport for a lot of the insurrectionary warfare that has bloodied places like Sierra Leone and Congo. And you have all kinds of African conflicts where they have to have weapons, and in defiance of the supposed embargoes purportedly placed on the transport of weapons to these groups by the United Nations, Boats has been using his air fleet, which includes, among other things, some of these absolutely huge Soviet air transport vehicles, to shuttle weapons, and then also to shuttle in peacekeepers. I mean, he's the living illustration of what Bastiat talked about in terms of creating the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory. This guy will fill up his planes at one point with arms and then ferry the arms into a region, whether it's Africa or the Middle East. He was also taking ordnance and all kinds of chemical and biological agents to the Taliban, allegedly in the late 1990s in Afghanistan. But it'll take that type of a load, that type of a payload to a destination. Then he'll turn around and he'll go somewhere else. Then he'll bring UN peacekeepers in to supposedly to palliate the conflicts that he's been exacerbating. And Victor Boat has also been involved, heavily involved, in some of the resupply missions for the so-called coalition in Iraq, because he has the right combination of aircraft with the right combination of personnel to fly those craft. And apparently, one of the things that's happened in this riotously off-the-books orgy of corruption in Iraq during the coalition...
Well, hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our other stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about a name named Mr. Bott, who is a former KGB general, who has the largest fleet of transportation planes and cargo planes in the world. They all belong to him.
Yeah.
Pretty good for just a fellow on a general salary. But, of course, what people don't understand is there are forces behind the scenes. There really are powerful spiritual forces which are directing everything that's going on. There is an invisible force out there, and until we recognize that, none of this really makes sense. I mean, how could you have these other people who really seem to have no loyalty to any country at all to really directing the course of world affairs? Well, we're not going to get into that, but those of you who have not yet gone to the website called Lucis.org, or Lucis Trust, LucisTrust.org, go to their website, read what they say about themselves, and understand they're one of the most powerful, well-financed organizations in the world today. And you'll never hear about that from Rush Limbaugh or from Sean Hannity or from Brian Williams, I'll tell you. But anyway, let's see. Before we go on, I want William to tell you how to get to his website, and then I want you to start going there every day to get the latest information. But how can people get your current writings, William?
I help write and edit the website called The Right Source for the Welsh Foundation. The address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. Not the right source, just rightsourceonline.com. That is the news blog for the Welsh Foundation. It contains a pretty consistently updated collection of news stories and also opinion pieces that I and the others involved in this enterprise think are worthy of people's attention. It also includes video clips, the occasional audio file as well. If you go to RightSourceOnline.com, look at the left-hand side of your screen, and then scroll down about a third of the way down the page, you'll find my photograph, and then there are two hyperlinks right next to my photograph on the right side of my photograph. The furthest one to the right will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate, a Latin phrase that means for freedom. And I say that it's a daily blog. That's a bit of an inaccuracy, in that I'll update it between 4 and 6 times a week, depending upon my circumstances. But the blog is not simply a web diary. The Pro Libertate blog offers, to the extent that I'm able to keep up with the pace of writing, between 1,200 and 1,500 or longer word essay every day, every other day, or however my schedule permits, that contains hyperlinks for documentation. Often it will contain references to things you can't get online, because I do go to conventional brick-and-mortar libraries every once in a while to do my research, or actually go out on foot doing shoe leather journalism. I'm working on a piece like that right now, for instance, regarding some things that have been happening here in Idaho. But the Pro Libertate blog is intended to be something of an investigative blog. It's not merely an antic commentary on what's going on in the news. What I intend to do with it is to take a look and peel the skin away and to dissect and examine in the way that a forensic pathologist would some of the things that are going on in the news that people may not be paying sufficient attention to. And it's all based on my compulsive, obsessive interest in human freedom, hence the name Pro Libertate. And I'm happy to tell you, by the way, that my most recent book is off the press now. I got a notice from Mark Horton, who is another associate of mine in the Welch Foundation, that they're ready to be shipped, and they're just nailing down the shipping details for my new book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And so in the next week or so, we should be able to ship off some quantity of that book, perhaps to you, Dr. Stan, for you and your enterprise there. And also, I'm going to have it available. The Welch Foundation is going to be carrying it. We're trying to get it into as many bookstores as we can get it into. If you have somebody on your Christmas shopping list who loves to be informed and a little bit terrified about what's going on, that is to say, to be usefully terrified about what's going on, this would be a really good book. It, in some ways, is like Judge Andrew Napolitano's very good book, A Nation of Sheep, although his book is much briefer than mine. We talk about the same kinds of issues. I go into more depth than he does because my book is roughly twice the size his is. But I think that if you've read Nation of Sheep, or if you're familiar with Judge Napolitano's radio show or the material that he discusses on his, for as long as he's going to be able to have this platform on this program on Fox News, chances are you'll find Liberty and Eclipse to be a very good supplement, because it goes into very great detail in terms of a number of really horrifying things that are happening and the creation of the garrison state that's springing up around us. So that should be available the next week.
All right, well, people have to remember that freedom is not free. There are very, very wealthy and powerful people at key positions in government who want a dictatorship in America, and step by step they're moving us in that direction. So go ahead, pick up the story.
Yeah, well, the pace is really accelerating. To bring perhaps to an end the discussion of Victor Boat and what's going on with Dubai, during the early years of the most recent war in Iraq, that would be 2003, 2004, 2005, during the reign of L. Paul Bremer as the proconsul for the Bush administration, heading the so-called Coalition Provisional Authority, the airline run by Victor Boat was very deeply involved in a lot of really nasty stuff. They were not only shuttling troops into the region for the United States and other members of this UN-created so-called coalition, but they were doing other things that people really haven't been able to get to the bottom of. And this is important because during the time that Jerry Bremer, an associate and accomplice of Henry Kissinger, somebody who had been involved in arming Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, that's an important part of this whole story, when L. Paul Bremer was running the occupation government in Iraq, you literally had hundreds of millions of dollars being sent from the Federal Reserve in shrink-wrap pallets that were being sent to Iraq and then broken up into bricks the size of footballs and thrown off the back of pickup trucks and flatbed trucks into the hands of heavenly knows who. And so a lot of the insurrectionary elements that were involved in the warfare that went block by block and street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood, in parts of Iraq, was probably funded in large measure by money that was printed by the Federal Reserve and sent over to Iraq with no accounting at all whatsoever. I wouldn't doubt for a second that Boots Airline was involved in at least some of this, both in terms of transporting the money and probably in terms of transporting the arms that were purchased with that money. We know that David Petraeus, the holiest and most sanctified personage alive, he whose word cannot be challenged, he whose judgment we must defer to, you know, General Julius Gaius David Petraeus, the savior of Mesopotamia, the one who's supposedly presiding over the world historic surge in Iraq, a few years ago was in charge of training Iraqi security forces, and when he had that portfolio, he managed to lose almost 200,000 weapons. They simply disappeared into the hands, once again, of we don't know who. Well, we can take a good guess that they ended up in the hands of the people who were shooting American boys in the streets of Baghdad and elsewhere. And those are the same people that are now being brought into the security apparatus. So I guess David Petraeus probably did create his security apparatus. He had, in order to bring about the supposed success of the surge, a program where they're bringing these insurrectionaries, these insurgents, many of them connected to the radical Wahhabist Sunni factions that commingle with Al-Qaeda. Those are the folks who are being brought into the security apparatus as policemen and as the equivalent of National Guardsmen. The militiamen there in Iraq, and the chieftains who were in charge of creating the resistance, the Sunni resistance cells, those are the folks who are becoming the power brokers. At the same time, of course, the Bush administration just a couple of days ago signed an illegal treaty with Nouri al-Maliki's government, which is a Shiite-dominated government, a party that was created in Iran in 1982. And that illegal treaty is a mutual defense pact, and to the extent that you can have mutuality between a puppet and his puppet master, that specifies that American troops are going to stay in Iraq for as long as it takes in order to provide security to the Shiite-dominated regime.
And I think that is such an important point. Within this last week, the Bush administration signed an agreement so we can, for all intents and purposes, keep our troops in Iraq indefinitely.
Yeah.
We can say, well, we're only going to stay there until things are stable. But as long as we're there, things aren't going to be stable because we're looked upon as occupiers. So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, this was all planned ahead of time. This had nothing to do with protecting us from weapons of mass destruction or getting rid of Saddam Hussein or bringing democracy to Iraq. It was part of a long-range plan to justify the permanent stationing and billeting of American troops in Iraq. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. When are you going to wake up and see what this is really about? It's all about the American empire.
Well, they wouldn't,
go ahead.
They wouldn't be building 14 bases in Iraq if they intended to be leaving Iraq anytime soon. What's happening is that they're building permanent military infrastructure in Iraq, and through that mutual defense pact that they signed, this illegal treaty, and by the way, it was signed through a video press conference because in spite of everything we're hearing about all the good news that's being suppressed by the media in Iraq about how the streets are stable and people are opening up, I don't know, wine and croissant shops or something in Anbar province. You hear all these things that are supposedly tokens of all the good news in Iraq, but Bush didn't feel comfortable enough, secure enough, to go to Baghdad to sign that treaty in person, and so he did it by way of a video teleconference with Nouri al-Maliki and the top echelon of his government. But the real significance here is that it provides a pretext for an attack on Iran, because all you need is one border incident involving the Al-Quds force of the Iraqi Revolutionary Guard, or Iranian Revolutionary Guard, rather, which has been described by the Bush administration as a terrorist entity. And there's a measure co-sponsored by Senators John Kyle and Joseph Lieberman that would formally designate that element of the Iranian military a terrorist entity. All you need is a border incident involving suspected members of that Revolutionary Guard, and you've got a pretext for a war with Iran, which is the transparent intention of the Bush administration. They want to have that war before Bush and Cheney leave office. Cheney has been working at the, I believe it's the National Observatory in the old executive office building down there, literally as if he were in a hollowed volcano, like the readout of, once again, a Bond villain trying to bring about some kind of a military overture against Iran. just looking here at a report by Philip Giraldi, who's a former CIA officer who now writes for the American Conservative. This is what Giraldi says. Some senior officials in the Bush administration are worried about the media campaign directed by Vice President Dick Cheney and carried out by Abrams, that's Elliot Abrams and Stephen Hadley, trying to link North Korea to a Syrian nuclear program based solely on Israeli-provided evidence. Cheney appears to actually believe that North Korea is helping the Syrians establish a nuclear program, and he has discounted the skepticism of the CIA. Then he goes, that of course has to do with that enigmatic bombing run that Israel made that apparently was a matter of simply demonstrating to Iran that Israeli jets can penetrate the Russian-installed air defense radar systems that Iran has been putting up. Then this is what Giraldi says about Dick Cheney in his hidden lair. Cheney is alleged to be directing the campaign from an underground operations center on the grounds of the Naval Observatory in Washington, where the vice president's official residence is located. Cheney regularly remains underground, staying in contact through secure video conferencing while his official motorcade proceeds to the White House each day as if he were in it. That's an amazing thing. You got the vice president essentially working around the president of the United States to organize a war with a country that has never attacked us.
Well, I think people have to understand that really the president is simply a figurehead.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney is the real force behind this, and he, of course, being a longtime member of the Trilateral Commission, is simply part of this whole international movement towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, and their intent, they're carrying out a long-range cosmic plan, I really believe, that calls for an attack on Iran with the idea that of getting the Christians and the Jews to kill the Muslims and the Muslims to kill the Christians and Jews. They want a worldwide slaughter. And where is the outcry? Why so many of our Christian leaders are supporting the idea of we got to do something about Iran before they attack us or before they attack Israel. And yet, of course, either our own CIA is totally incompetent or they're correct, and they say there's no danger for another 5 to 10 years. So somebody is lying to the American people, but I share William's opinion that it's only a very short period of time before we're at war with Iran. Oil goes to $150 a barrel. It cripples our economy. It creates tremendous civil unrest in America. There is a master plan out there that they're not going to tell us common folks. But go ahead.
Well, one thing that I should point out here about the CIA, my impression is that the CIA is sort of a compound of things that don't really go well together. When I was in Washington, D.C., I spent a lot of time around people who worked for the CIA in various capacities, and a couple of people who obviously did but weren't going to admit that to me. My impression is that if you're talking about people who are involved in analyzing data, the CIA does a pretty good job. They do have a really good intelligence capacity. The CIA has been spectacularly wrong about some things. For instance, they vastly overrated the economic performance not only of the Soviet Union but East Germany. For years and years and years, it was believed that East Germany was somehow this industrial colossus when it was the industrial equivalent of a unicycle. It just simply didn't work for a very good reason. But in spite of that fact, and that was all politically dictated for the most part, that was an element within the CIA that it later on morphed into what became the group that ginned up the phony intelligence about Saddam Hussein. But the thing is, there are good, competent people working in the CIA who do keep an eye on what's going on, and they do work sources that are well-placed, and they analyze their intelligence soberly, and they do put out a work product that is entirely commendable. It's the operations director of the CIA that I think is appalling, because that's where the real business end of the CIA is located. That's where the Dulles brothers would go around giddily subverting governments and sowing and fomenting conflict abroad to advance this objective, these agenda items you're talking about. They have to create conflict abroad, subvert governments, bring down potentially friendly or actually friendly governments, replace them with perfectly abhorrent ones. That's what the CIA has excelled at. It would be wonderful if we had a CIA that was actually involved solely and exclusively in collecting useful intelligence for our policymakers. But with respect to what's going on in terms of the larger picture that Iran is part of, I think one very important element of the story here is that over the last couple of years, who's been buying up all the gold in the world? It's Russia. Russia now has the largest I believe, the largest gold reserves of any country on the planet. They also have one of the largest foreign exchange reserves of any country on the planet because the energy price has gone through the roof. Russia is to natural gas what Saudi Arabia is to petroleum. I think it's monumentally important that Russia has gone out and bought gold. Why do you buy gold? Because you expect things to go really bad in the economy. They, I think, are pretty hip to something that's going on or that's coming down in the near future, and that's worth looking into.
Well, I think that's really so very, very true, and I hope many of our listeners out there will get our little pamphlet entitled The Communist Capitalist Alliance. The term comes from Solzhenitsyn. But, of course, why did Russia become the largest producer of natural gas in the world? And the largest producer, actually, they've actually now surpassed Saudi Arabia. And it's because we drilled the wells for them. We provided the money. That's why you need to get that pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alliance, why we've created the best enemy that money could buy. Well, William, got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
I do think that one of the things we're going to see in the very short term is a war with Iran. By they, I'm referring primarily to the Bush administration. They have been trying to engineer a war for many, many years. Ironically enough, it is Tehran that has been doing what it can to prevent momentum in that direction. And I think that one of the things that will happen if, heaven forbid, we end up in a full-scale shooting war with Iran is that we're going to find ourselves in danger of losing almost our entire functional military, which is right now bogged down in Mesopotamia. We end up with a war with Iran, and they close down the Persian Gulf, they close down the Straits, we end up with the entire Muslim world, the entire Gulf region turned against us. We're going to be in the same kind of a situation that the Roman Empire was in the last few years before the Christian era, when they sent an army into Germany and lost it. I mean, there was that despairing cry of Caesar Augustus when he said, "Varus, Varus, bring me back my legions." Well, he couldn't, because Varus lost them in the forests of Germania. And that's the same type of a predicament we could find ourselves in right now. May God spare us such an outcome, but that's pretty much where we've been backed into, the corner we've been backed into by the people who are ruling us. I don't think that really anything in our history as a nation can prepare us for what we face right now. Things don't change dramatically in a hurry.
I share your concerns. You know, most people have never thought, you know, the implications of losing a war. There's only one worse thing than fighting a war, and that would be losing a war. We have never lost overtly a war. We didn't lose in Vietnam. We simply betrayed the men who went there to fight because we never tried to win. And the same thing was true with Korea. But now, of course, if we get into a war with the Islamic world, we could certainly unintentionally lose that war and lose a large part of our fleet that's over there. People better start stopping and think of the implications of where we're headed and start making their plans accordingly. And join William and I and those others who are trying to sound the warning that there are people at the highest echelons of our government who hate America and want to destroy this nation and want to plunge us into a terrible war where we will lose literally millions of our people, of both civilian and military. William, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and as always, we'll look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Thanks so much. God bless, Dr. Stan.
God bless you, too. Fine. And our guest this evening has been William Grigg, and we do hope that you'll go to his website and get his material, and we'll be right back to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and there are few people that I agree with as much as I agree with William. But all of our experts really seem to be convinced that the war with Iran is coming. I hope and pray that they're wrong, but everything convinces me that they're absolutely right. And the implications of this war, the average American doesn't understand. America is bankrupt morally. America is bankrupt fiscally, financially. We're having to borrow money, $2 billion a day, just to simply pay our bills. And as William says, Russia now suddenly is financially stable. They have reserves over $440 billion. We don't have reserves like that. We don't have any reserves. We're borrowing more money all the time just to pay our bills. But you will be feeling very good to know that we are still funneling money into Russia so that they can improve their oil wells, improve their gas wells. You need to get my little pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alignment. It's simply four or five of my newsletters put together. We have so much material. You need to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy, our pamphlets on foreknowledge 911, why 911 occurred, and how the CIA and the and NSA and all of our various intelligence agencies created this whole radical Islamic movement. And they've been working for years to create the best enemy money could buy within the Muslim world and now within the communist world again as we build up the economy of the Soviet Union in preparation for a coming war with them. So please go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can see many of our DVDs there, the history of the wars of the last century. They were all contrived. And, of course, then you'll want to listen to our programs, which are archived there free. Read our newsletters. Read Major General Smutley Butler's article back in 2005, War is a Racket. Read the newsletters. Check out the facts. We have the documentation. We are involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Now, quite frankly, we need your help. We need to expand. We can't do it without you. We do not have any large donors. We just have a lot of little people who agree with me that there's a problem, and they're keeping us going, but we do need help. We'd like to send the end of this year in the black. So if there's any way that you can possibly help us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Join the Radio Liberty family. Become part of our team. And we have a team. And we have a team that's reaching out across America, touching people's lives and bringing them into a realization that the story of the Bible is real, that there really are organized evil forces, secret societies, working as part of a conspiracy against God, and that's the common denominator of everything going on today. And if you have a Bible or you have a concordance, look up the word conspiracy. You'll find God uses it over and over again. Why? Because there's always been a conspiracy against God. There was one in the Garden of Eden, and it exists today, and it involves some of the most powerful people in the United States who are pretending to be Christians, who are exploiting the Christians, but of course, in reality, they're working for the other side. And if you want to read the writings from the other side, go to LuciusTrust.org. That's www.LuciusTrust.org. Understand what these people are up to. Get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. That's the occult hierarchy. And then, of course, get some of our DVDs. The Forbidden Truth. We recommend this to you. It comes with a syllabus. The Forbidden Truth, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. Certainly the four tape sets on The Secret Behind the Secret. The Secret Behind the Secret. The fourth CD or four tape sets. Let me suggest Alex Jones' latest DVD, Endgame, Going into the Bilderbergers. And you really, of course, will want to get our four tape set on the impending police state. That's the impending police state. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Tom, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line from Southern California, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson held a professorial position at the MB Anderson Clinic in Houston, Texas, and, of course, was on the editorials board of a number of scientific journals and has in the neighborhood of about 600 peer-reviewed articles in the literature, which is quite unparalleled. Very, very few people have very many peer-reviewed articles. He's a prolific writer. He's certainly known throughout the scientific world for his work. Of course, we're going to be talking to him today about his experiences as he began to delve into the Gulf War illness and chronic fatigue syndrome and the experiments that were done on the prisoners at the Huntsville prisons in Texas and, of course, what happened to he and his wife as a result of their effort to help people who have these terrible, terrible diseases, these terrible disabling diseases. And of course he's written a book which we carry called Project Daylily. Now it's a faction book. It's written as fiction, but it's really based upon fact and the incredible experiences he and his wife had. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. Dr. Nicholson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us as we begin to, of course, go into the background of the fascinating book you've written, Project Daylily. So, just for our listeners who may not know who you are, could you just give us a little rundown, fill in the blanks from what I said?
Well, I'm currently the President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Institute for Molecular Medicine here in California. And this is a nonprofit research institution dedicated to discovering new diagnostic and therapeutic protocols for treatment of chronic illnesses. And we deal with a lot of different types of chronic illnesses. We work with autoimmune illnesses, for example. Fatiguing illnesses, like you mentioned, Gulf War illness and chronic fatigue syndrome are two of the most common fatiguing illnesses, but there are others as well. We also work with rheumatic diseases, things like rheumatoid arthritis and sarcoidosis and other rheumatic diseases. We work on cardiopulmonary problems, such as asthma, also cases of atypical pneumonia. And we also are involved in cardiovascular problems, such as vasculitis, coronary problems, all sorts of problems associated, as it turns out, with infection.
All right, fine. Of course, you actually, of course, have been working with a lot of people with neurological diseases because there really was a very, very high incidence of so-called Lou Gehrig's disease with the veterans of the Gulf War, weren't they?
Yes, there were several times higher incidence than expected of Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, Gulf War veterans. Also, multiple sclerosis and other neurologic illnesses as well.
So, of course, there's been a conscious effort to convince both physicians and the public that Gulf War illness was really nothing more than post-traumatic stress. But as you began looking into this, why you found, of course, a great deal more. We'll cover that when we get back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And could you go ahead and just give us a little bit of the background of the Gulf War illness for our listeners out there and how this more or less overlaps this series of symptoms and signs of this physical illness, how this overlaps with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, which affects really about 2 million people are said to have had chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and then somewhere between, about a third to a half of the veterans of the first Gulf War?
It's approximately a third of the veterans of the first Gulf War have come down with a variety of different problems. The most severe of those turn out to be illnesses that are essentially the same as chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, except that they progress, and they can progress to a lethal form of the disease, which you don't often see in civilian cases of chronic fatigue syndrome, although it can happen, it has happened. These people die of premature death with the neurologic problems or cardiovascular problems or other problems. And they don't just have chronic fatigue. And we found out early on with the veterans coming back from the first Gulf War, that's at the time period when the Pentagon and the VA was trying to tell everybody that it was a psychological problem, post-traumatic stress disorder, and none of the signs and symptoms fit with that. Or let's say the certain signs and symptoms didn't fit with post-traumatic stress disorder at all. They were medical signs and symptoms. And we found that they were due to chronic infections. And one of the chronic infections that we found, which is the story Project Daylily, is an infection that actually had been worked on by the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology for several years. The experts were, turns out, all in the Army or worked for the Army. And Army pathologists at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology had been working on this infection. It turns out this is what at least 40% of the Gulf War veterans who came down sick had this particular infection.
Now, weren't they working on it as sort of a biological warfare agent?
Well, that's what we think, because it was being tested in the prison system under the guise of a vaccine development program that was sponsored by either pharmaceutical companies or directly by the Army. And various prisoners were coming down sick and dying, and the guards were getting sick. And we got involved because the guards and their family members came to us for assistance. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, one of these gals called us up on the telephone. Her husband was the assistant warden in the Walls Unit, which is a condemned prisoner unit in Huntsville, Texas, at one of the prisons.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And Dr. Nicholson was talking about this chronic fatigue type of illness that seems to be related to a mycoplasma infection. He was mentioning that just recently why the wife of one of the wardens there at the Huntsville Clinic had called him. Pick up the story there.
Well, what happened was that the entire family had become sick because of these infections that were being tested in the prison system. It passed to the prison guards and the administrators and the healthcare workers at the prisons, and they took the infections home and they passed to their family members. And this one family was absolutely riddled with disease. In fact, the daughter was diagnosed with ALS at Baylor College of Medicine. But she didn't have a real ALS or true ALS. She had an atypical form, which means that most of the diagnosis was presented as ALS, but there were some atypical aspects to it. And this really concerns the infection that she had. And when she found that she had this Mycoplasma fermentans that we also found in the Gulf War veterans, she was placed on antibiotics as quickly as possible. And eventually she recovered, and she went on to have two healthy children and lead a normal, healthy life. And she was given a life expectancy of 2 years when we met her. So these people have all kinds of different problems. It turns out this family, the husband retired, they went to Kansas, and now they're living in Oklahoma, and they're all recovered and doing quite well now. And we've seen this over and over again, where people are denied proper care and treatment because to hide essentially the types of illnesses that they harbor. And in this particular case, we feel that they actually were exposed to a biologic weapon. And the reason for that is that when we started studying this one infection, this Mycoplasma fermentans, which is one of the infections that we found on the Gulf War veterans in more detail, we found that there were some unusual genes associated with it. And one of the genes happened to be from the HIV virus, the envelope gene. And this told us that there was something very peculiar going on, because there's no reason why that particular gene would be associated with this bacterial infection. And then when we started studying this further, we found out that, well, one of the things that this infection does is it invades cells very quickly, and that may be the reason why this particular gene was inserted. But there were other genes as well, genes to improve the survivability of the organism, to make it more heat-resistant, and so on. And all these smack of weaponization, they just smack of modifying an existing pathogenic microorganism to make it more pathogenic and to make it more survivable out in the real world. And so it just, to us, it just smacked of a biologic weapon. And that's what we hypothesized was in play at this particular prison and in some of the veterans that came back from the first Gulf War. Now, unfortunately, in the second Gulf War, we also have veterans that are coming back, and the DoD is trying the same story all over again, that they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I don't think that's the case. But epidemiological studies, both done in Kansas and done in the UK, support the notion that these infections are probably picked up in the vaccine. So you can see why they want to hide this fact from the American people, that these might be friendly fire casualties that we're seeing, not only from the first Gulf War, where there are over 150,000 that are sick, but also now from the second Gulf War, that soldiers are coming back, veterans are presenting with some of these unusual signs and symptoms. So we have the problem, history is repeating itself all over again, and that is unfortunate, because we thought that we'd put it behind us and that we'd buried our mistakes, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, of course, the thing is that when you began to look into this, that's when your whole life began to unravel. In other words, when you were simply, working there at the MB Anderson Clinic and doing your research, that was all well and good. But when you began looking into this possibility of a biological warfare agent, which of course is in violation of the various treaties that we passed, that have been signed and supposedly the law of our land, when you began looking into that, why then? Then, of course, you came under tremendous pressure. Would you like to get into that? Because that really is the subject of your book, Project Daylily. What happens to a scientist, when he begins to try to get to the bottom of a disease that is afflicting literally millions of people in America?
Well, literally, my whole life was turned upside down, and that of my wife's as well. I mean, they literally destroyed my career in Texas, and I was an endowed full professor. I held a very prestigious position, the David Bruton Chair in Cancer Research. I was a professor and chairman of a large department and had approximately 100 people working for me. And the administrators at the Texas Medical Center, went after me to the point where they hounded me so much that I just decided to leave because of the pressure and of the attempts on our lives. And this is covered really in the book. I had a superior of mine who was shot in the back of the head in his office. I've had two of my students that died under mysterious circumstances. It became a very unsafe place for us to work. And the book goes into that in detail and how we escaped many times. And so we decided that we were pressing our luck a little bit too much, so we needed to get out. And so we did. We left Texas and came to California, and we set up a nonprofit research institution to study these chronic illnesses that so many people are suffering from.
Well, now, the superior, the gentleman that was shot in the back of the head, wasn't he a retired officer, either Air Force or military colonel or something? And he had told you within a few minutes before he was executed that he was going to come forward and talk about the things that you were delving into?
Yes, he was actually planning on blowing the whistle on the prison experiments because he didn't like it. He didn't believe in it. He thought it was wrong, and he thought it was totally unethical. They were also involved in some nursing home scandals where outside of San Antonio there were some rest homes or nursing homes which we hypothesized acquired basically to test some of these organisms. So I didn't even know it at the time that my own institution was involved in some of these horrific experiments. And so this is one reason why they went after me and went after my wife. And so it was a real horror story for us. And we turned it into a medical thriller, which is really what it is, and finding the answers for people. That's a success of the story. And escaping and telling the tale is the other aspect of it, which is kind of interesting to a lot of readers.
Well, I think it's important to have the book out there because I think in some of respects you're far better off to be a big target than a small target. And when people sort of forget about you, that's when your life is really in danger. As has happened to a number of the people that I've interviewed who have been very courageous and have, I believe, been killed for it. The last one was Gary Webb, who'd written a treatise on the CIA and drugs. He we're told he committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice.
Well, we've run into a number of things like that as well, and quite frankly, it's a very common technique to get somebody and either get them into an accident where they lose their lives or get them to so-called commit suicide. And in fact, some of my colleagues in Houston were down as suicides, and they weren't suicidal. We knew that. We knew what happened. We knew that they'd stumble across things and were very vocal about it, and so they presented a threat, and they were eliminated because of that. So we didn't want to find ourselves in that situation.
Chris, I think it's very difficult for the average American to believe that this could really happen in the United States. And where is the FBI? Where is our police agencies doing something about it? And I'm sure that we have many good police officers, but many times people in key positions are there for one and only one purpose, and that is to cover up and prevent an effective evaluation of what happened. Now, whatever happened to the gentleman you said he was shot in the head, I think twice, he was your superior. Wasn't he retired Army colonel or Air Force colonel?
Well, he was a retired Air Force colonel and a physician, and he was the vice president for patient care at the institution. And unfortunately, he knew a lot about the programs, the classified programs that were going on in the military. So he had a background already in the sort of thing that we were involved in. So he was very very kind to us, very supportive, and tried to help us whenever he could. I think what happened, he just overstepped the bounds, I guess, and it cost him his life.
And of course, but what about the investigation? You find somebody with two shots in the back of the head. Obviously this is a murder. What about the investigation of it?
Well, actually, he was shot six times in the back of the head.
Six times in the back of the head.
And back of the head and the shoulder in his office a few minutes after I had actually spoken to him early one morning. And the crime was never solved. And it was a professional hit because the person had gone in and escaped the institution and knew exactly where every security camera was located and knew exactly how to get in and out of the building and not be seen
by anyone. Who would know how to hire a professional killer? Other than people who were professional killers.
Well, we can speculate a lot. We think we know who did it. In fact, our hypothesis is actually presented in the book, and I won't tip my hat on that. I want people to get the book and read it because it goes into a lot more information than what we've just described on how these programs started and so on. We actually looked into this in much more detail, and we found that the microbe that we discovered in the veterans was actually probably a microbe that came back in Operation Paperclip after World War II when the Nazi scientists were being brought back to the United States after being rounded up by the CIA, or then was the OSS and the Army after World War II. So it actually has its origin in Eastern Europe. They were testing these weapons in the death camps to see how effective they were, and we grabbed a lot of these scientists after World War II and brought them back and then tried to refine further these weapons because we knew the Russians were doing the same thing.
Yeah, of course, they were very, very effective weapons of killing human beings. They're biological weapons. We're not supposed to be experimenting with them. And yet, of course, as we'll probably mention later, there have been well over 100 biologists or microbiologists who've died under very mysterious circumstances in the last few years. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. One of these, as a matter of fact, was coming to visit us who'd replicated some of our results on the genetic modifications in the mycoplasma fermentans, and he died under very suspicious circumstances on his way to our institution.
Well, the book is Project A. Lily. I've read it. I read the original draft of it, or one of the original drafts, and I'll tell you, it's a book that's difficult to put down. If you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about his book, Project Daylily, and I was just saying, I have read the book, and I'll tell you what, it is a real thriller. Of course, I understand what Dr. Nicholson is talking about. There's a lot of fascinating information there. It's written for the layperson, but a doctor can certainly get a great deal out of it. And, of course, it meant a lot more to me because I've had the opportunity of actually interviewing a number of people who are described in the book. Of course, their names are changed, perhaps a few of the details are changed, but I certainly was very, very pleased to see them described. And these are heroic people, little people out there who have part of the puzzle. They're simply one dot on the chart, but you begin to collect these dots on the chart, and you begin to see truly a diabolical movement involving people in key positions in successive administrations and in science who are prostituting what they're doing, and they have applied their scientific knowledge and their brilliance not to helping people, but to learning how to destroy them more efficiently. What about the origin of the AIDS epidemic, and how does that play in here? You mentioned that these mycoplasma fermentans that you found had a gene from the HIV virus. Now, how could a gene from HIV get onto a mycoplasma unless it was inserted there, you know, in the laboratory?
Well, that's exactly what we think happened, along with some of the other genes. But another interesting aspect of this is that HIV-AIDS itself is a very complex, multiple infectious process, and it's not just the HIV virus, as most people think. The HIV virus is actually not pathogenic, although it does suppress the immune system, and this can result in a number of opportunistic infections getting hold in a person with the HIV syndrome, and that's what really kills people. And one of the most common one is the mycoplasma fermentans. And in fact, the Army's been studying this for years, been studying the mycoplasma as a cofactor in AIDS, and some people think it's the real pathogen in AIDS, and it really sets people up for the final events of AIDS, and then they get all kinds of opportunistic infections and then die.
And so basically it's a dual infection, HIV, and then this mycoplasma as well, and certainly they sort of work together. The HIV lowers the immune system, and then of course the mycoplasma can come in and actually invade the cells and kill them.
That's correct, and it does so in a very insidious way. And in fact, one of the pieces of the puzzle just came out. One of my colleagues in San Antonio just published a paper showing that toxins are released by the mycoplasma. And these toxins damage the cells in ways that we don't entirely understand. But he's been studying the respiratory effects, and he found that the toxin released by the mycoplasma really damages the respiration cells, the cells that line our lungs that were responsible for our breathing and so on. And these cells are literally killed by this toxic molecule, and so they have to be replaced. And if they're not replaced, then pulmonary damage, permanent pulmonary damage, can occur. So there are also some other things that we know are released from these little mycoplasmas when they get inside our cells. And these we've been studying in a little bit more detail. They're called activated oxygen species, and what that means is that they damage cellular structures by oxidizing them. And they damage our DNA, for example, and one of the critical structures in our cells.
Would you hold that thought for just a minute as we bring our other stations right back on board? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and he's certainly talking about how the mycoplasm works and actually destroys the cell, and certainly, or at least certain parts of the cell, releases toxins that can severely damage the cells of the lung. But you were going to be, I think, probably mentioned what they do to the mitochondria. This is the mycoplasm, which is associated with HIV. In other words, AIDS is not simply HIV infection, contrary to what most doctors and most people think. It is a combined infection. There's HIV, and most of the people have a mycoplasm. What percentage of people have the mycoplasm, do you think?
Well, it's at least 80%, according to the studies done by the Army, and it may even be higher because these infections are actually hard to detect. It can be detected, but it's really quite difficult because they hide inside our cells, And most tests are done with blood samples, and very little of these microbes get loose in the blood, so we can detect them.
All right, now what about, you were going to say that, I think you were going to talk about the mycoplasma, was it hitting the, or attacking the mitochondria?
It does. The mitochondria are the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy for all of our cellular functions. And there's some tissues, such as the tissues of the central nervous system, that require a lot of energy to operate. So, in fact, some of the nerve cells burn six times as much energy as other cells in the body. So they require these mitochondria inside the cells to be very active and produce a lot of high-energy substrates that the cell can use. And what happens is that the membrane of the mitochondria gets damaged by oxidation, by these molecules released from the mycoplasma, and it becomes leaky. And when it becomes leaky, it's just like stripping the insulation off a battery and then trying to put it in your flashlight. It won't work anymore because it's run down. The energy is escaped from the battery, and the same thing happens with our mitochondria. The potential across the membrane, the chemical potential, can't be maintained. And so that it's just like shorting out your battery, and they can no longer produce the high-energy molecules. And so this is what we found out happens, although we found some products that can reverse that and help patients with chronic fatigue quite a bit.
Now, you'd mentioned before something called Propax. Is there any? How can people get that? And, of course, are there any other products? What about CoQ10, for instance?
Well, there are a lot of lipid products and cofactors of lipid metabolism and so on that help. We've just gone directly to products that replace the damaged lipids entirely. And so these are all dietary products like Propex or NT Factor. And people can find out about these by going on our website, the Institute for Molecular Medicine, which is www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org, and you'll find your way to our site. They can also just do a Google search or a Yahoo search and find us right away. And if they look under various categories there and look under fatiguing illnesses, for example, they'll find articles on how we've used these products to restore mitochondrial function and to help people with their fatigue. And we've done studies on people during aging, because you lose a lot of mitochondrial function just naturally during aging. We've done studies on people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. We've more recently done some studies with Gulf War veterans, and now we're just initiating a study with U.S. Navy SEALs in Afghanistan that are operating in a high altitude. All these individuals have problems with their mitochondria. Either they're being stressed and their mitochondria run down because of that, or because they have infections and their mitochondria are being damaged. And so they need to repair the membranes of the mitochondria, and that's what this dietary product does. It supplies the undamaged, unoxidized lipids so they can be naturally replaced through our normal metabolism. And that's the neat thing about this product, because we're not talking about taking a drug which could have potential side effects. We're talking about taking something that's completely natural that your body needs anyway and ordinarily would get through food, except that normally lipids are oxidized during food. And this is mainly why food becomes rancid, because oxidation occurs and things like lipids and proteins are damaged and they can't be used as easily as we think once they're damaged.
Now, how do you spell that? Propac, is that P-A-C-K or P-A-C?
No, that's P-R-O-P-A-X.
Oh, P-R-O-P-A-X, okay.
Propax. And there's a website, actually, www.propax.com. People can go on that and see some of the scientific studies that I've just mentioned.
All right, and is it taken by mouth, though? Is it
yes.
In the form of pill or capsule?
No, it's a dietary supplement.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about so many of the veterans of the first Gulf War, approximately a third of them, came back with a Gulf War illness, and many of these, of course, have chronic mycoplasma infections. Of course, the government did everything they could to conceal this. Dr. Nicholson has testified a number of times for Congress and very prestigious organizations. He's traveled. He was a visiting professor in Kuwait for a time, where many people have a great deal of illness following the first Gulf War. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about, of course, what they have found as they began looking into these fatiguing illnesses, as they began looking into the Gulf War illness. And, of course, there are many other diseases out there where we have multiple infections in the human body. One of the more interesting things is increasingly become apparent that so many people who have arterial disease and heart attacks have chronic infections as the basis for this. Oh, we think, oh, we just take enough statin drugs and get our cholesterol down, that's going to be fine, but half of the people who have heart attacks have a normal cholesterol. So then what part do these chronic infections play in heart attacks? And are some of our younger people dying as a result of these chronic infections?
Well, we do know that. In fact, when the Gulf War veterans came back, there was an unusual number of heart attacks among this generally young group, average age less than 25, and that was totally unexpected. And one of the reasons this happened was that they had infections like Mycoplasma fermentans, which can cause what's known as a vasculitis or an inflammation of the vascular system. And when this occurs, there are a lot of what are called pro-inflammatory molecules that are released into the circulation. These increase the clotting rate, and so little clots or thrombi form in the blood, and these lodge in the capillaries in a variety of different organs. And when this happens in the heart, it can cut off the blood flow to the heart and eventually lead to ischemic heart disease and a major heart attack. And this is exactly what happened with a lot of the veterans. We see a lot of people that have these infections that have abnormalities in blood clotting properties and the presence of these thrombi in their blood. And that's, again, due to the vasculitis or the invasion of the endothelial cells that line all of our blood circulation, all of the capillaries and all of the venules and so on and so forth in our body. So this can be a very dangerous situation if it gets out of control. And we've seen a lot of people, particularly elderly people, are very high risk, and also the very young. And the very young are very interesting. One of the things that we found from the Gulf War was that as these infections slowly spread to immediate family members, the adults were being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, but often the children had some very unusual learning disabilities and behavioral disabilities, and they were often getting diagnosed with autism or attention deficit disorder or some of the other autistic spectrum disorders. And at first we didn't really understand what was going on there, but we knew that these infections could penetrate into the central nervous system and cause problems. And in a developing brain, this is exactly what you don't want to have.
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We have a caller from Johnstown, New York. I'm going to ask him to hold on for just a couple of minutes because I want to develop this idea of what's happening to the children. Now, we know from many studies that have been done, certainly the Regal Committee report, Senator Regal investigated the Gulf War illness. He felt that about 70% of the wives of veterans were sick. The wife came down with the disease. According to the Rockefeller Committee report, which we actually carry as a report from the Veterans Administration, they said about 40% of the wives of ill veterans were ill. And now Dr. Nicholson is saying that many of the children of the ill veterans who came back from the first Gulf War, these children were reported with autism or learning disorders or things of that sort. So obviously this is a communicable disease, despite the fact that the CDC and the NIH and the Veterans Administration do not want the American people to know the truth. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. There's been a lot of red herrings put out, particularly in these autistic spectrum disorders. And, of course, this is not the only factor that's involved. We know that there are other factors, for example, heavy metal exposure, chemical exposure, and so on. All of these illnesses that I've been discussing are usually quite complex and involve a number of different factors, not just the infection that we've been talking about. So it's one thing to fight the infection, but other things have to be done to these patients as well. If they have heavy metal exposures, to remove them. If they have chemical exposures, they have to be treated in certain ways to remove those chemicals from their body and so on and so forth. So they're really quite complex diseases.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to our first guest, who is Daryl, who's calling from Johnstown, New York. Hi, Daryl. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I did. It's to my knowledge, in our brains, we have chemicals called endorphins. And they are they aid the antibodies in, you know, curing certain diseases, you know, attacking certain germs in our body. And they are released, only to my knowledge, and I could be wrong, by emotions. And I wondered if there was any other stimulant towards endorphins that would get them to release to aid in helping cure certain problems.
Okay.
I have another question.
Well, okay. What part do endorphins? Do endorphins play anything in part in what we're talking about, Dr.
Well, we really don't understand the role that they play, as well as any of the other neurotransmitter compounds that could be involved in these various neurologic illnesses. These are very complex relationships between the body and the mind, and when you have an infection involved, this kind of throws some of these systems out of order, and you do see some unusual things that come out of it.
All right. I think, Daryl, that endorphins really control pain, and this is the thing. Certain exercise will release endorphins. When you release the endorphins, they're almost like an opioid controlling the pain. Now, did you have another question for Dr. Nicholson?
No, just an experience that I had. You were talking about the military and how they don't want to, you know, release certain information. I'm a two-tour Vietnam combat veteran, and in 1967, when I went into the service, and I was on my way over to Vietnam, what we had to do, because of the lack of dentistry within the Army, and orthodontists and things like that, what they had us do was, you know, get in a group, and they gave us a very small toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste that was very high in fluoride and very abrasive. I believe they used a pumice. And we had to brush our teeth, you know, each tooth one at a time, with the substance, and I wondered if that, you know, destroyed a lot of our teeth by taking the enamel off the surface of our teeth.
I have no thoughts on that at all. Do you, Dr. Nicholson? I
really don't either, because I really don't have enough information to really comment on that.
Oh, I think Daryl...
Well, we all had to do it because there was a lack of dentistry within the service.
Okay, don't know anything about it, but thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Jeannie Soderman. Jeannie, did you have a question?
Well, Dr. Stan, I am on topic, and I did read Project Daylily, and Garth Nicholson, you're just a hero to me, writing this book, and it's a researcher, but on page 524, that's something very interesting that you wrote, and it was regarding the Nevada Trust, and I'm going to give you a website, because the Lear family of William P. Lear Sr., who invented the Learjet, car radio, you name it, he was especially brilliant, it's called NevadaScams.com. And there is a lawsuit against the trustees, the attorneys, the district judges, and the Supreme Court judges of Nevada for stealing money from the Lear Trust. And so there again, the website is Nevada Scams, that's SCAMS.com. And there's two generations of the Lears that are putting lawsuits on this, and it will go to the United States Supreme Court. And you might be interested in that, Dr. Nicholson.
And, of course, for our listeners out there who haven't read the book, of course, there's talk about a Nevada Trust, which, of course, belongs to Dr. Nicholson's wife. Anything else you wanted to say, Jeannie?
No, that's it. And thanks, Dr. Nicholson, for your courage in being such a great guy.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Jeannie.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, one of the aspects of the book is how do you finance all these programs and keep it secret? And one of the things that we stumble across was the fact that trusts were being misused to support some of these programs, like the MK Ultra program, for example, the Manhattan 2 program, which was the development of a variety of different biologic agents and vaccines against them and so on.
And so these were actually Nevada trusts, weren't they, and having to do with the gambling interests there in Las Vegas?
There were a number of different trusts. One was the Manhattan Trust, one was the Sterling Trust, one was the Siddhartha Trust. All these were very large trusts that were supposed to be for humanitarian purposes, but they're being misused.
And, of course, there's a great deal of medical experimentation that is going on today. That is not for the betterment of mankind, I fear, but for the destruction of mankind. And that's a rather frightening concept, that scientists would actually engage in that sort of thing. But I'm sure that many times they are recruited into these programs. Would you have any comment on that? Because I've certainly looked at the information that's come out of these various reports of the Special Virus Cancer Project, which they were all supposed to be destroyed. The CIA project, all the records were to be destroyed. They're not really very good. They didn't destroy them all, and we actually have some of those. I'm sure you've seen them as well. An awful lot of leading scientists were involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. Why would they do something like that?
Well, scientists are recruited all the time for various projects, and often they're given such a small piece, and they don't really understand the big picture, and they don't know how it fits in with other pieces, but they're offered contract money to pursue this line of research, and then they write up the reports and turn it back in, and often they never know what became of the research that they did, and often it's compiled and put together in some offices somewhere, in a covert way, and then that information is used. And so there are a number of different programs which have been going on. I mentioned the MK Ultra program, but there are all sorts of different classified programs that were going on where certain aspects of research they would contract out to certain people. There were over 120 universities in the United States that were involved in these kinds of projects, so this is not something that was done in a little corner laboratory. This was done in all the major pharmaceutical companies, all the major universities, and so on, were heavily engaged, and they were all reaping the economic benefits from these programs.
And yet, of course, an awful lot of the scientists ended up very, very dead. And in fact, the last one I remember had been found stabbed half a dozen times and stuffed in the trunk of his car with somebody set on fire. Why would anybody do that to a microbiologist? I mean, what could a microbiologist know that was so dangerous? And as you begin to read the book Project Daylily, I think that you'll begin to get a picture of why they would want to eliminate people and why Dr. Dickelson left his tenured position, MB Anderson Clinic, a fascinating adventure story. The only trouble is, certainly there's an awful lot of truth in this story. Well, what sort of response have you gotten from the scientists and others who've read the story?
Well, we've actually gotten a lot of good response. I haven't gotten any negative response yet, but then again, they probably wouldn't tell me directly about it. But we have a lot of good feedback. In fact, we have a website for the book, and people can actually read the comments from some of the leading scientists in the world. There's a Nobel laureate, for example, and several department chairmen that have made comments on the book. So that's projectdaylily.com. It's run together as one word.
All right, fine. That's projectdaylily.com. And we have another caller. Let's see who it is. Who is calling?
Lorna?
Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. As far as mercury exposure and that type of thing, I believe that my daughter, through her shots, had some problems because she had what they call the lazy tongue syndrome and starts stuttering. And
now you're talking after her vaccination shots?
Yes. And I was wondering what his suggestion would be as far as detoxing children.
All right, you're talking about detoxifying children. Now, did she have any contact with anybody with a Gulf War illness? Was this just a direct something that followed after her immunizations?
I think it was directly after her immunizations.
All right. Do you have any thoughts at all on that, Dr. Nicholson?
Well, we see the parallel between what happened, for example, in the Gulf War experience, where the multiple military vaccines were studied and shown by epidemiologists to be directly related to Gulf War illness after the Gulf War. And this is studies done in the U.S. as well as in Great Britain. Now we see the parallels in children who are undergoing developmental change at an early age, and they're given all these multiple vaccines, and there's an alarming rate of autism and autistic spectrum disorders in these children. And is there a relationship between those and the multiple vaccines? I think there is. But one of the ways in which this is being studied is that they choose a particular vaccine or group of vaccines, and then they study the relationship between that vaccine and illness, and that's not the way you do this type of study. You've got to take all of the vaccines and study them all at once, unfortunately, because it's probably the multiple vaccines. The vaccines themselves can be very immune suppressing, and either contaminants in the vaccine or opportunistic infections that are in the environment can get in these children and take hold, and then there are other exposures as well, either heavy metals, some of which are present in the vaccines, or some chemical exposures in the environment, and all of this can combine to give these developmental and learning disorders that we see in these children.
Well, one of the things that's always bothered me is that certainly we know in the original polio vaccine that they gave all of us, there were all the monkey viruses, and that was in the rhesus monkey. One of those, of course, was a cancer-producing virus, SV40, so they switched over to the green monkey, and we got all of the viruses from them. And then sometimes we have, you know, the vaccines that are grown in chicken eggs or embryos, and then we got all the viruses. Are any of those viruses harmful to people, or do we have any way of knowing?
Well, there are studies, for example, that have followed, for example, you mentioned the SV40 virus, which is known to be a cancer-causing virus under certain conditions, so these viruses can contribute to pathogenic events. There's no doubt about it. And one of the other problems in the vaccines, one study that was done showed that 6% of them are contaminated, for example, with mycoplasma. So 6% doesn't sound like a large number, but when you are vaccinating thousands and thousands of children, all of a sudden the numbers become very realistic.
Well, Lorna, do you have any suggestions at all as far as Lorna? What could she do, or what should she do as far as her daughter is concerned?
Well, you know, the thing that we tell people that have these problems is that, number one, you have to get to an expert that study these so that you know exactly what you're dealing with. That's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to try and determine if they've been exposed to heavy metals, to chemicals, to some of these opportunistic infectious agents and so on. Once you have that information, then you can proceed on some kind of a treatment program for these children.
Well, I don't know that there's that many experts, and the cost involvement might be not possible for us right now to hire an expert in the
field. Well, this is a problem that we all face, and we have people coming to us all the time, and one of the first things that they tell us is that, you know, I'm broke. I've been to see 50 physicians. They can't figure out what's wrong with me. I've got this problem, that problem, whatever, and we try and help them. So if there are people out there that you know, we'll try and help them. They can send an email, which is the best way to contact us, and we'll try and help them. We can't make referrals because we're a nonprofit institution, but we can point them in some general directions where they can get help.
How would it be the email address that, that people would send to?
Well, it's on our website for the Institute for Molecular Medicine, again, which is www.immed.org. Just remember, immedia.org. Or they can look it up on Yahoo, for example. We do try and help people that have these problems.
And, of course, the first thing you have to do, Lorna, you have to make a diagnosis. You have to find out, I mean, really what the basis for it is. So why don't you send an address to Dr. Nicholson. Go ahead.
Okay, I also wanted to say, I don't know, have you ever heard of GI Guinea Pig, the book?
What's that?
It's called GI Guinea Pigs. It was a book about experiments and stuff they were doing on the World War II veterans.
Well, we've had misuse of military personnel ever since probably the Civil War for various medical experiments.
And
so this is nothing that's new.
GI Guinea Pig, my dad, it was really funny because he was in the Veterans Hospital in California, and all of a sudden somebody had the book, and he's like, well, wait a second, that's me. And he was in a picture. He was decontaminating somebody from radiation and nuclear exposure with a whisk broom, sweeping them down.
I will tell you, the tragedy is that they experiment on our men in the military. It's criminal activity, and yet those people have no comeback at all. This is well covered in the Rockefeller Committee report from the Veterans Administration, which we carry. They use our military as guinea pigs. That's why I will not advise any young person to go into the military, because you lose your rights, and if they destroy your life or kill you experimenting on you, why, there's never any repercussions. It's one thing to be willing to die to protect your country. It's another thing to be used as a guinea pig without your consent or knowledge. Thank you so much for calling. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
All right, fine. And so our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. His book is entitled Project Daylily. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. It's a fascinating adventure story. You couldn't make up anything this incredible, and yet, of course, it is based upon the true story of Dr. Nicholson and his wife, who stumbled on a mass series of experiments we're carrying out on, of course, on prisoners at Huntsville and other prisons, and, of course, on our servicemen would appear in the Gulf War. And the great tragedy is we're talking about several hundred thousand veterans of the first Gulf War are ill, and we know at least 25,000 of them have died. A very successful experiment. Well, Dr. Nicholson, we've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What was your thought you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, we've been talking about the book Project Daylily, and the more people know, I think the better armed they are to deal with these issues. The worst thing in the world that we could do is to hide our heads in the sand and pretend that these things don't exist and that our government is just a benign entity that is looking out for us, because often it's not. And some of the people in power are truly vicious and even evil. And we need to expose these people and get them out of government positions and get them out of laboratory positions where they can do harm to other individuals. And unfortunately, there is a program called eugenics that has been persuasive in the United States ever since the beginning of the last century. And this program exists and is still continued to this day. And there are people promoting this type of program to reduce world population and reduce the pressure, they think, on the United States of America by limiting the population of the world. But these issues and these ideas, I think, are absolutely foolhardy, because the methods that are being used, infectious agents, for example, cannot be controlled. You cannot control a microbe. You cannot control a microorganism. It will ultimately come back. And you would have thought that we'd learned this from Plum Island and Lyme disease, which originated in old Lyme, Connecticut, just across the bay from Plum Island off of Long Island. And once these diseases get out, then they spread, and Lyme disease is spread all across the United States and into Canada, and it will continue to spread. And by the way, one of the most important co-infections in Lyme disease is a mycoplasma. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I've been asked to speak at a number of Lyme disease conferences, because most people weren't aware of this. They were aware of some of the other co-infections in Lyme, like Ehrlichia and Babesia and Bartonella, but they weren't aware of the mycoplasma. And this is the most prominent co-infection in Lyme disease. So these types of diseases can lead to chronic illnesses. In some cases, they can progress to lethal illnesses. And so we're not talking about something that's some mild form or somebody else's problem. We're talking about something that could be your problem, and it could be your life.
Amen to that. Well, Dr. Nicholson, thank you so very much for being with us this evening, and we look forward to having you back on our program in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I'd love to come back.
Okay, God bless you. Good night. All right, that was Dr. Garth Nicholson. I hope you've enjoyed our interview with him this evening. If you'd like, of course, a copy of the entire hour-long tape, I would make it available by calling 1-800-544-8927 at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and everybody dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, and then we on a weekend program try to get people to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men against truly wicked forces, and of course ultimately for the survival of Christian civilization. There are people who would destroy Christian civilization, and there were people who would destroy the sovereignty of our United States, and many of them are working at the highest levels of our government today. Now, Sydney, if you'd like to get the book or Project Daylily or know more about it, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to begin to put a lot of this into its perspective, we do have a video, a talk I gave called Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction, and it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We actually have a four-tape set on the Gulf War illness. We have a four-tape set on population control. We have a video on population control. We've written the population control monograph, where we simply quote the people who talk about the importance, the vital importance of eliminating 90% of the world's population. We take you to Elberton, Georgia, and the great stone monument there, the American counterpart of the British Stonehenge, which is a great occult monument where they have satanic ceremonies. And I've been there on several occasions. And there, engraved in stone in eight different languages, is the Ten Commandments that come from the pit of hell. And point one is, maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. And people say nothing like that could happen. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I believe it can. I believe it's coming. I believe it's coming very, very rapidly. In fact, Barbara Mark Shepherd, one of the wealthiest women in the world, wrote a book in the original manuscript, which we have copies of. She wrote about, actually, her book was channeled to her by, I believe, a demonic spirit. She called it the Christ spirit. The Christ spirit. That told her that, you know, the Revelation 6:8, and look and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him is death, and of course power was given unto them, and Hades followed close behind, and power was given to kill a quarter of the population of the world with by the sword, and by hunger, and by pestilence and death. And then she went on to talk about how there were people that just wouldn't evolve to the higher levels. They were about a quarter of the world. They were going to have to be eliminated. And then she went on to say, that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse, death. A woman who ran for the vice presidency of the United States in 1984, Democratic nomination against Geraldine Ferraro. There really are people out there like Jacques Cousteau who talked about the necessity of eliminating 365,000 people a day. If you'd like to verify what we're saying, we'll send you other pages from the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website, radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs 5 hours a day. And then tell other people about our program. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so till we're together again, may the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.